study in the Psalms. So we want to start with our summary. Psalm 84 anticipates the restoration of Israel and joyful worship in Zion. So I'll go over that again. Psalm 84 anticipates the restoration of Israel and joyful worship in Zion. Outline, simple outline for the psalm being two parts, verses 1 to 7, joyous return to Jerusalem. Verses 8 to 12, blessings through God's anointed one. So we'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 7, joyous return to Jerusalem. Verses 8 to 12, blessings through God's anointed one. All right, so let's go to our observations. Psalm 84 is a psalm for the sons of Korah. As you can see in the superscription, to the chief musician upon Gittith, a psalm for the sons of Korah. Now, the psalm for the sons of Korah, which we had a group of those in book 2 that we looked at previously, some think that these were psalms that were written by David, but written for the sons of Korah. Certainly don't think that fits or would be the case, particularly in these book 3 psalms. But the sons of Korah were Levites who were gatekeepers and singers at the tabernacle and temple. Korah, the original Korah, was the one who rebelled against Moses and Aaron and was swallowed up by the earth in Numbers chapter number 26, though his children were spared. And so these were his descendants. The Korahites were a group that ministered at the tabernacle and then later at the temple in the times of David and of Solomon. And they're also mentioned serving in that capacity more than a century later in the time of Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles chapter number 20. So we know that they endured for a long time. Most likely, though, these particular psalms would belong to that group, but would be psalms of a much later time from the time of the exile. It is directed to the chief musician, as you can see, or to the choir master, the song leader. It is upon Gittith, which most likely refers to a musical instrument. Some type of a harp is likely, though that's not entirely certain. We do have two Selahs in the text at the end of verse 4 and at the end of verse 8. There's no other musical direction that is given to us. There's no occasion that is given for the psalm in the heading. The text does speak of pilgrimage to Zion, but it gives no indication that any such historic pilgrimage is in view. And really, when we read the psalm in context and in its placement here in the Psalms, it certainly is much more future-oriented. To categorize, Psalm 84 is a Zion psalm, so that the psalm itself speaks of Zion and expresses longing and desire for Zion, which would be a future-looking Zion, a restored holy city, Zion, which would be the place where God's anointed Son King is enthroned. This is also has some minor elements to it. It's a beatitude psalm, so we are describing the blessed state in verses 4, 5, and 12 in this psalm. Would also consider it a royal or a kingly psalm, as we have mention of the king in verse 3. We also have mention of the anointed one in verse number 9. Psalm 84 is the first Korahite psalm in book 3. There is a group of Korah, sons of Korah Psalms in book two. That would be Psalms 42 through Psalm 49. In book three, we have Korah Psalms. This one, Psalm 84. The next one, Psalm 85. Psalm 86 is actually a Psalm of David that is stuck in book three. And then Psalm 87 and 88 is another Sons of Korah Psalm. And then the last Psalm of book three, Psalm 89, is actually a Psalm of Ethan the Ezrahite. So obviously, being a psalm for the sons of Korah and belonging to that group, it does have connections with the previous group of psalms, Psalms 42 to 49. But it also has connection with other Zion psalms, which two of those come from the earlier Korah group, Psalm 46 and Psalm 48. But another Zion psalm would be in Psalm 76, as well as Psalm 87 after this and Psalm 122. So there are not a lot of Zion psalms, so to speak, but they all would obviously be connected. It also has a number of connections with Psalm 1 and Psalm 2. So for Psalm 1, we in this psalm, we see the blessed state of those who walk uprightly. And in Psalm 2, the blessed state of those who trust in Yahweh. And so we have both of those elements here, as well as some other connections like the anointed being in Zion, which would be in Psalm 2 as well. There's also connections with Psalm 24. Psalm 24 is that psalm of the King of Glory. And the King of Glory in Psalm 24 is the divine warrior king that enters Zion victoriously, which is the same thematic elements that we have here in this psalm as well. Poetic features of Psalm 84. One would be a central motif of progress. So as you look kind of at that middle part of the psalm, I think verses 5 to 7 in particular, you have movement. You've got depiction of a pilgrimage to Zion. You got description of passing through a valley, also of going from strength to strength, which is an expression of progress as well. You also have different imagery in this psalm. You have little birds nesting in the psalm. You have the imagery of going from arid land to well-watered land. And you also have some military imagery with the mention of the Lord of hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth, which appears, I think, four times in the psalm. There's also a use of repetition, the term blessed, obviously, verses 4, 5, and 12. The title Lord of Hosts in verse 1, 3, 8, and 12. And those will be the primary poetic features that we would observe in this psalm. All right, so let's work our way through these 12 verses. I'll go ahead and read this psalm. How amiable are thy tabernacles, O Lord of Hosts! My soul longeth, yea, even fainteth for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh crieth out for the living God. Yea, the sparrow hath found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Even thine altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. Blessed are they that dwell in thy house. They will be still praising thee, Selah. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee, in whose heart are the ways of them, who passing through the valley of Baca make it a well. The rain also filleth the pools. They go from strength to strength. Every one of them in Zion appeareth before God. O Lord God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob, Selah. Behold, our God, our shield, and look upon the face of thine anointed. For a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man that trusteth in thee. So verses 1 and 2 that open the psalm give us expressions of praise and also that of great longing, beginning with this ascribing of beauty and desirableness to the tabernacles. And the word is used in the plural there in verse number 1, and that actually points to the temple or tabernacle proper, as well as all the courts and all the surrounding parts of the complex itself. Lord of hosts is a term Lord of armies. essentially. Sometimes it's Lord of Armies in the sense of the hosts of heaven, the angelic hosts. Sometimes it's Lord of Hosts in the hosts of Israel. And so it can be used in a couple of ways. Generally, when we see it without any other context, Lord of Hosts generally refers to the angelic hosts and armies. And Lord of Hosts is a military type title. In fact, it gives us that divine warrior motif that we have encountered a number of times in the Psalms. It is also the same title that is used in Psalm 24:10, where the King of Glory, Lord of Hosts, victoriously enters into Jerusalem. There's also mention here in verse number 2, we get some of that repetition that gives emphasis. So we have soul, heart, and flesh. And that obviously captures the whole being, the whole person. So this is not, in other words, the longing that is being described at the beginning of this psalm is being given the fullest possible expression. It's not just a wish. It's not just a fancy. You know, it's not just that you see something and you think, oh, I'd like to have one of those, and then you go on and forget about it. No, it's not that. He is whole body and soul longing and desiring. He describes it in longing, fainting, and crying out, giving that emphasis for the deep desire and soul thirst that he has for the living God, which is an expression that's used in Psalm 42:2 as well. Verses 3 and 4 give us the blessed state. So we have this mention of the sparrow and the swallow there in verse number 3. So these are small birds, and these are defenseless birds. And they're also quite worthless birds, very common, very worthless birds, not any high price or value to them. And so the expression here is a matter of praise and observation of God and his dwelling, that the least creature may find refuge in God's presence, even down to the sparrow. And of course, you recall that Jesus used that as an illustration as well, that God cares for and feeds the sparrows, which are essentially sold for nothing. They're of no real value. And how much more then does God care for you? And Jesus talks about that in places like in Matthew chapter number 10. So it's very similar to what we see here in this psalm, as the psalmist is reflecting on the fact that even these lowly creatures may find refuge in God's presence. And this contributes actually to something of a humility motif in this that we get here and again in verse number 10 in this psalm. Now, the mention of the altars of God obviously evokes reconciliation and peace and safety in God's presence. And again, we get the Lord of Hosts, this military title. It is repeated three more times in this psalm. What is interesting about that is, as you read the psalm, there's no hint of military imagery, of battles, of armies, of weapons. There's nothing like that, which you would expect to find with this sort of a repeated emphasis. Well, the fact that we don't have any further military or war imagery, in fact, the imagery that we have is quite peaceful and quite serene. We have a well-watered valley. We have these little birds finding refuge. And so we get all this imagery that's leading us to think of peace and tranquility. And then we have this title, this warrior king title, which seems harsh to be put in this sort of a setting. But what this gives us, though, is actually the vision of the victorious warrior king. So if you think back again to Psalm 24, this warrior king enters Jerusalem victoriously, and Psalm 84 is looking at this victorious king in Jerusalem and the peace that has reigned as a result. So it's not as discordant as it might first seem. When he expresses my king and my God, he's expressing on the one hand the universal reign of God, and I mean universe, you know, over all, and the universal reign of God that has come to the earth, a global reign. And we get expressions like this in Psalm 5 and verse 2, the other chorus psalm, Psalm 44 and verse 4, Psalm 47 verses 6 to 7, some later psalms, Psalm 68, verse 24, and Psalm 74, 12. And then we get the beatitude of those who dwell or abide in God's house, in His presence, and that there will be continual praise. As we come to verses 5 to 7, now we get the beatitude of those whose strength is in the Lord. And beatitude, and blessed as it's used here, beatitude is a word that comes from the Latin. So beatitude or blessedness here refers to a state of blessedness. This man has come to a state of blessedness. The one whose strength is in the Lord, he is in a state of blessedness. Now the ways that are spoken of here in verse 5 that are in the heart refers to the ways to Zion. So these are pilgrimage terms for journeying to Jerusalem, particularly for the feasts. And his strength is the Lord, and his heart is set on Zion, is what this verse is expressing to us. In other words, his heart is set on dwelling in the presence of God. So this is a pilgrim, a traveler, a sojourner, but one that has a purpose, one that has a destination that is being aimed at, and his heart is set on. The traveling imagery continues. We get this reference to the Valley of Baca. It is uncertain where the Baca Valley was located, and there are a lot of different ideas about that, but I don't really think any one is any more valuable than another, because it's just something that we just cannot know for sure. But nevertheless, we can understand the imagery that is being used here. So if we think about passing through a dry and a difficult valley, all right, so that's sort of the imagery that we're getting. And this dry and difficult valley becoming a well-watered and even fertile place. So this imagery is given to us because the traveler is on the way to Zion, but the way to Zion is fraught with dangers and difficulties and desolations and all of these sort of things. So what we're getting from this image that's communicated to us in the psalm is that the destination makes the rough road less rough in a manner of speaking, or at least it makes it worth the trouble. So this difficult valley is worth passing through because of the fact that you're going to arrive at Zion. The expression going from strength to strength is actually the language of reviving and renewing, which we're going to see a lot more of when we get to the next psalm in Psalm 85. So they are growing stronger the nearer they get to Zion. And probably what the way that the imagery would work. So you imagine traveling on a very long journey and going over a difficult road for whatever the reason may be. But then as you see those signs that you're actually drawing nearer to that destination, you sort of draw some fresh energy and some fresh courage. So if you've ever done that, you've ever driven a long, long distance and you've had a difficult portion for whatever reason. Like for instance, when we used to live in Mississippi, it would take us about 2 hours to get from our house to the interstate. And that 2 hours was on a strictly monitored 50 mile an hour, two lane road that there was literally nothing on. And so it when you started out and you did that 2 hours, you got to the interstate, it was fine. But when you're driving back and it's late and you've been on the road all day for hours and hours and hours, it would always just sort of deflate me when we finally got on the trace. And I think, oh, because I know it's just going to be just endless nothingness in the dark, 50 miles an hour, two lanes, hardly ever see another car or another person. But when you finally are getting toward the end of it, you would sort of at least get a little bit revived. That's over. I've got that past me. You know, now I'm getting to my destination. Well, that's just one example that we experience. Well, that's the sort of imagery that the psalmist is communicating to us. This difficult valley is made less difficult or tolerable, you might say, because of Zion. And Zion is the place of God's presence. And that is where the psalmist is longing to be. Verses 8 and 9 then give us, in the midst of this psalm, a prayer for God's anointed. So we have this direct address request to God to be heard, to hear my prayer. And we've seen this sort of thing before. That is a covenantal type of prayer to the one that is in covenant relationship with God, requesting to be heard. There's grounds to be heard, not because of merit or anything like that, but because of that relationship. And we also have other covenantal terms, reference to the God of Jacob, strongly covenantal term. So this is a covenantal reference and appeal to God. We have God described as a shield, which is another covenantal reference of divine protection that we have seen Psalm 3:3, Psalm 7, verse 10, Psalm 18, 2 and 30, Psalm 28, 7, Psalm 33, 20, and Psalm 59, verse 11. So the phrase to look upon the face of thine anointed, or to look on the face, that phrase means to show favor and to bless. And here it is for the anointed, the Messiah. That's the word for Messiah, the anointed one here that is being spoken of. This is a reference to the Davidic king, all the way back, starting in Psalm 2 and verse number 2, coming forward in places like Psalm 18, verse 50, Psalm 20 and verse 6, Psalm 28 and verse number 3. And we also have it in verb form in Psalm 45 and verse 7, that he has been anointed with the oil of gladness. Verses 10 and 11 speak to the good that is in store for those that come into God's presence in Zion. So we get verse 11, or verse 10 rather, this humility motif again, being a doorkeeper in the house of God. And we have this statement that one day is better than thousands. One day in God's presence is better than thousands outside of that. So that goes along again with this idea of this journey and this difficulty of journey being worth it because of the destination. So one day is worth thousands. That means that thousands spent outside of that presence of God is worth it to be in that presence of God. Doorkeeper is obviously a menial position. It's a lowly position, and it's better. He'd rather be that than dwelling in the tents of wickedness. And wickedness here refers to violence and even criminal activity. Humility in God's presence, he's saying, is far better than divided spoil with the proud. Ultimately, they will be destroyed. Now, we have here God referred to as a sun and shield in verse number 11. And that is the only time in all the Psalms that God is referred to as a sun. That metaphor, this only time in the Psalms that this is used, is right here. And another place that this is used is in Malachi chapter 4 and verse number 2, in reference to the Messiah who will arise, the Son of Righteousness, with healing in his wings. Now, shield, reference to God as a shield, is obviously more common. We saw that just a little earlier, the covenantal reference of divine protection. And so God as a protection is something that we see in the earlier chorus psalm, Psalm 46 and verse 7, Psalm 48 and verse number 8. So the imagery of God being a sun and a shield is the imagery of giving life and protecting life. So God is a giver of life, and God is a protector of life. And it goes on to say that he will not withhold any good thing from those who trust in him. This psalm ends in verse 12 with the beatitude of the one who takes refuge in Yahweh. And that's the word for trust, to take refuge in. That's a covenantal term for trusting in God, for seeking protective shelter in God, starting back in Psalm 4 and verse 5 and coming forward in numerous psalms after that, that this word has been used. Again, it's a covenantal term. All right, so let's go to our interpretation. Well, Psalm 84 teaches that the only place of true and real happiness is in God's presence at peace with Him. This is the only place of true and lasting joy and satisfaction, and that is being in God's presence at peace with Him. So we have references in this psalm like to the beauty of the temple, which gives us sort of an architecture, sort of element. The beauty of the temple and its design and the aesthetics of it and so on. We have references to the altars. We have references to the way to Zion and to the city itself. But ultimately, as you read this psalm, it's the presence of the living God that is longed for. In other words, it's not just the beauty of a city or the beauty of a temple, of a structure, but it's the presence of the living God that is longed for. So this psalm also answers the question of who will enjoy God's presence. Who will enjoy God's presence, both in terms of, you know, who will come into that presence at all, but who would enjoy being in that presence as well? Well, we get that answered directly in verse 10. It's the humble. In verse 11, it's the upright. And in verse 12, it's the trusting, those who are trusting in Yahweh. Well, the messianic hope is seen in Psalm 84, particularly in the prayer for the Messiah in verses 8 and 9. So we actually have the word, the term used there, the anointed one, in verses 8 and 9 in this prayer for him. So as we think about the way that these psalms are flowing, particularly here in book 3. So the Asaph psalms in Psalm 73 to Psalm 83 that precede this psalm, they reflect the devastation of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple, and the exile from the land. And those laments that we see, and they were primarily laments in those Psalms of Asaph, those laments are praying for the restoration of Israel and judgment on the enemies. And so that Asaph psalm group built up to where in Psalm 83, we had Israel surrounded by enemy nations and God bringing judgment on those nations. So as we continue on here in Psalm 84, we see exactly what we would expect to see following that that eschatological program that we see laid out in the Old and New Testament. In Psalm 84, the victorious king has come to Zion. And he's come there to restore the people of Israel and establish God's presence in the holy city. So the prayer in verses 8 and 9 is right in the midst. And in fact, it seems almost out of place. This psalm, it seems to roll along, and the verses before and after 8 and 9 seem to all go together. It's almost as if you could take 8 and 9 out of the psalm and it would read fine. 8 and 9 almost seem to disrupt the psalm. But there's a prayer here in the midst of what otherwise is a joyful anticipation. And so this prayer, though, is crucial. You take 8 and 9 out and you ruin the message of this psalm. Because this prayer shows that all of this that is anticipated is dependent on God's anointed Son King. Just like we see in Psalm 2, just like we see in Psalm 24 as well. So it is the triumph of the anointed one, the Davidic King, that means reviving to Jacob. And grace and glory and every good thing to the least person who trusts in Him. All right, let's go to our applications for this psalm. I have two of these. Number one, Psalm 84 helps us understand the long, dry journey is made worth it by the destination. So, everlasting life with fullness of joy in God's presence makes the troubles of this life fade and even disappear by comparison. And Paul speaks to that in Romans chapter number 8, that future glory can't even be compared to our present sufferings. In other words, our present sufferings are going to be nothing compared to that future glory. In 2 Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul was very similar when he talked about that our afflictions in this mortal life are light and momentary compared to that eternal weight of glory. So this psalm taps into that message in the Scripture that, yes, this life is a hard, long, dry, dangerous journey, but that destination makes it certainly worth all the trouble, even though sometimes in the moment it may not feel like that. Number two, Psalm 84 helps us understand that God in Christ is the greatest treasure, reward, and eternal delight in the universe. There's nothing better. There's no one better. Not beautiful temples, not beautiful cities, not green valleys, but God Himself. And being in His presence at peace with Him is the greatest treasure and delight our souls will ever know. The real desire of the psalmist is for the living God. And that is true faith. So not just that we desire to escape judgment, not just that maybe we hope for a better life without the troubles of this present one, and just as Paul said on down in 2 Corinthians 5, that our desire is not just to put off this tabernacle. Our desire is more about what we're going to put on. So that is true faith. We must take care also to realize that there are things that feed our desire and longing for the presence of the living God, and there are also things that rob our soul thirst for the presence of the living God. If you remember how your grandmother would warn you about snacking and then it would ruin your dinner. You're so hungry, but you take some candy or you snack on some things, and then you don't really get that full enjoyment and full experience of that dinner had you waited just a little longer. And that's really the way that we can be in our desire and longing for the presence of the living God. There are many things out there that can sort of give us a substitute and give us maybe a momentary feel, but ultimately they're robbing us in the long run. So we must take care of that.